This is Isaka's Page 2 Podcast.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. You're listening to an Isaka podcast. I'm your host, John Brandt, Isaka's Information Security Professional Practices Lead. On today's episode, I'm speaking with Tony Anscombe, the Chief Security Evangelist for ESET, to discuss ESET's threat report of T1 2021. Thanks for joining me, Tony.
Oh, it's great to be here, John.
But I tell you what, this report that for our readers is comprehensive. I was looking through it, a ton of information here, very detailed. I'm really super jazzed for you to be on this call with us and for the information you're going to share with our membership. For our readers, I just want to quickly clarify, right, during the info, ESET's report is a triannual report is how they position it. And for our audience, I think why that's important here is just because whereas other reports may be monthly or quarterly or semi-annual, periodicity matters. And from ESET's perspective, T1 represents January to April of any given year. T2 is May to August, and T3 is September to December.
No, well, I was just going to say that's correct. You know, we decided to do three reports a year. We have previously done four reports a year. But as you said, this report is pretty extensive and actually takes a lot of resource from our side to put together. So three a year allows us to still have that quality of information, but on a slightly longer cadence.
That's excellent. Without further ado, we'll get right started here. The ESET threat report shares that ESET researchers discovered more than 10 different advanced persistent threat APT groups that were exploiting Microsoft vulnerabilities to compromise thousands of servers. Can you share more about this discovery and your findings?
Yeah, sure. So you'll remember the Microsoft had an issue with Microsoft Exchange vulnerability. So some zero-day vulnerabilities that were unfortunately disclosed or being exploited in the wild prior to there being a patch available. So they were being exploited by some of the bad threat actors out there. So for example, Lucky Mouse, Calypso, WinNTI group were all exploiting these prior to actually the vulnerability being disclosed and the patch being available. And we identified shortly after that, if you look at the timeline, we identified around 5,500 email servers in 115 countries that were affected. And basically, these vulnerabilities allowed bad actors to connect into those Exchange servers and one, compromise the Exchange server, but two, they could go beyond the Exchange server, so with remote code execution, and actually leave what I'd define as a later useful method into a network that would then give them access. You know, it's kind of like a bumper day, John. Imagine when you find this vulnerability, you're a bad actor, and suddenly you can drop your bad stuff on all these different servers. You've probably got too many servers for you to go and attack today, but if you can go and leave droppings on them all that you can come back to later and then go and attack them later on, that's pretty much what we think they were doing.
Yeah, that's a lot of work from your researcher group there. It's a lot for your average company to track, right? At the end of the day, and I, to your point, is having the access back to the servers, and basically to check to see whether or not they're available over time, for some predetermined campaign, right? And it's disturbing because Microsoft is a de facto standard, if you will, right? That's out there.
Yes, but also, let's be clear, all software at some stage, vulnerabilities appear, and it's about how, one, they're disclosed, about how quickly they're fixed, but also about how quickly the end user deploys that fix to actually lock down that vulnerability with the right patch or the update. And in this I think was a fairly unique and interesting one, because there were a lot of servers that got patched very quickly. You know, if you walk into an enterprise, you've got a security team and you've got resources on hand that will patch and understand what they're doing. We step into that smaller business sector, then you've got a lot of smaller organizations that one may not have understood the severity of the vulnerability, and also may not understand how to deploy the patch or the update quickly, and may be reliant upon a service provider or a reseller or somebody outside their organization to come in and do that for them. And in this instance, the FBI actually stepped in and removed all the web shells from the servers en masse. And they had that was a court authorized operation. And that's a fairly unique happening. But what it didn't do, it didn't go that one step further. It didn't then patch all the servers, because that would be then the FBI modifying the active server code. But I believe they were actually contacting the organizations that the servers belong to. So there was a proactive law enforcement campaign behind this as well.
Oh, absolutely. And that was actually pretty interesting, because and there were some, that was not just a US-based effort, if I recall correctly, right? There was some global cooperation on that, wasn't there?
I believe so. I believe some other law enforcement organizations and agencies around the world did similar things as well. But and that's important, that actually companies and law enforcement work together against cybercrime.
Absolutely. Those are great points. So, you know, one can't talk about cybercrime and not be talking about ransomware, right? At the end of the day, where there's some, obviously your smaller enterprises may struggle to communicate the importance of cyber hygiene and just good cybersecurity practice in general. But when ransomware comes into play, it makes it really a very tangible thing. So your report references a statistic from Group IB that the average ransom jumped from $80,000 in 2019 to $170,000 in 2020. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, let's give you some real examples as well. I think that always helps, doesn't it? If we go back to that 2018 timeframe, so actually slightly earlier, you know, do you remember the City of Atlanta smart servers suffered a ransomware attack? And at the time, the bad actor demanded $51,000, which in today's world seems rather small. And when I say today, we're only actually 3 years ahead from that time. But at the time, $51,000 was a lot of money, and Atlanta turn around and, in my opinion, did absolutely the right thing, and the right thing everybody should do is not pay the ransom. And they decided to rebuild their systems. Now, if you then look about a year to 18 months later and look at the published reports on how much it cost the City of Atlanta to rebuild their systems. Now, in rebuilding, that's not only a replacement of the hardware or the infrastructure that was damaged, but it's also a furthering of security. So it's, you know, a greenfield scenario where you're going to enhance security, you're going to deploy new systems, etc. But it cost them $17 million. And that was a breakdown of around $11 million, I think it was, on hardware, and $6 or $7 million on software. If we then look, if we go around that same time frame, slightly earlier than that Atlanta attack, the NHS in the UK suffered through the WannaCry attack, and they also published. The good thing about when it's a state or local authority is you tend to get the post-mortem numbers of what it cost to actually rebuild. Reportedly, it cost the NHS in the UK $121 million to rebuild their systems. So now you've got these, what I define as stake-in-the-ground moments, where if you were being, if you're attacked and you get a ransomware payment or a ransomware demand, and if your board is sitting there looking back and going, well, the ransomware demand is for, you know, $1 million or $2 million, and they suddenly look back and they look at the City of Atlanta or they look at the NHS or any of the other published cost of recovery from ransomware, where it's costing tens to maybe hundreds of millions of dollars to recover, you know, the $2 million demand doesn't suddenly sound that bad. But therein lies the problem, isn't it? The cyber criminal knows this too. So suddenly he's gone from demanding 51,000, I say him, it could be a her. So they have made a demand from $51,000 and they've now suddenly realized actually the businesses are willing to pay and they're willing to pay much more. And to couple this on the other side, to the side of this as well, you've also got cyber insurance playing a role in this. So you've got cyber risk insurance suddenly appearing on the market and companies can insure. As long as they have the security in place that complies with the cyber risk insurance, then actually they're not paying with their money. They might only be paying with part of their money because the insurance company is going to send over a negotiator, negotiate with the bad actor, and they're going to pay on the company's behalf.
So when we talk about cyber insurance, right, and I think it – we should probably just spend a moment there because, you know, there's this belief, right, that cyber insurance is a panacea, right? And I think anyone who's seen some of the earlier policies and maybe even currently, like there's always with any insurance policy, there's the terms and conditions or the exclusions. And I think that's one of the it's a notable risk, right, that has to be acknowledged.
Yes, but cyber insurance shouldn't be viewed as the answer to this. The answer to this is actually my opinion is the answer to this is regulation of cryptocurrency. I mean, if you take the money out of this, then the entire thing might change itself. So if somebody started regulating cryptocurrencies and putting legislation in making that part different, then I think we'd see less cyber crime. But you know, ignoring my, because that's a much bigger rant and we could have a much longer conversation on just that topic. But if we go back, you know, there's no guarantee that if you get attacked, that the cyber criminal is going to give you a decryptor even if you pay. Yeah. I mean, there's that first piece in there as well. If the cyber criminal is on the sanction list, so i.e. or is associated with their infrastructure is associated to be on the sanction list, it's actually illegal to pay them. So whether your cyber insurance company or whether you're paying them, you know, could actually get you into an awful lot of trouble because then your business is going to have breached sanctions, which then means your bank and your insurance company and you are then all in breach of that issue as well. So it may not actually be legal to pay them. And as of yet, I don't think we've seen, and if somebody knows differently, I'd love to hear from them. I don't think we've actually seen an organization prosecuted for paying somebody on the sanctions list for ransomware. But I don't reckon it's that far away.
Well, I think that's a great point. I think, and when you had touched on, you know, your smaller enterprises, you know, when you don't have robust security teams or even executive teams, right? You know, and I think there is a legitimate issue is if you're unaware and don't pay attention to the sanction list versus unsanctioned and don't have a compliance body or legal or you're not a strong legal counsel relationship, that very well could set the stage for that.
Yeah, and exactly. And that's why companies should be taking the right precautions and the right protections so that they don't become a victim of ransomware. And even in the scenario where, you know, the unfortunate does happen, you need to have the right process and the plan in place so that you can recover from it. And that's the important part.
So one last question on this on this area here is from your perspective, right? The two examples you gave were, those are governmental examples, right? Like, so obviously, at least here in North America, specifically United States, there's a means and methods to get access to certain information, Freedom of Information Act or whatnot. You do the risk analysis, right? At the end of the day, the taxpayer is the one that's going to foot the bill normally. But then on the corporate side, are we seeing that that decision is, you know, that cost benefit analysis is actually that they're being transparent with it as to what the actual recovery costs were?
The recovery cost is difficult. I haven't seen any commercial companies in that way publish in the same way. And as you said, the Freedom of Information Act, you know, the UK has very similar legislation there that it than the US enjoys as well on things like that, which is why I was using state or authority-based examples because that data is available. But if you look at some of the bigger payments, I mean, some of those have been hitting the headlines recently. You had Colonial Pipeline, as we know, paid $4.4 million. CNA, the insurance company, reportedly paid $40 million. You had the likes of Garmin, who, according to most reports, paid around $10 million. And I think you had JBS paid over that $10 million mark as well. So there's some big ransoms being paid out there, some very big ransoms. And the problem is by paying, you are resourcing and you are funding the next cyber criminal attack, because you're making this a very rich payday for a bunch of cyber criminals.
Absolutely. And you know, and it's definitely not trying to diminish, you know, the often difficult decision, right? And I think it's easy to Monday, you know, the armchair quarterback this after the fact. But, you know, the proactive stance in some of these other things, it does generally seem like we're encouraging the behavior by continuing to pay out. Which leads us to my next question here is, you know, how does the recent executive order and announcement by Department of Justice change things here in the U.S.?
Well, it certainly puts focus on the cybersecurity issue, which is absolutely what needed to happen. And I think governments around the world are starting to put big focus on it. And then just to finish off that ransomware discussion we were just having, just interestingly, it may interest you to know, John, that Australia have just made it, there's a proposed bill going through their legal system to make it illegal to pay the ransom. So I think that governments will start changing legislation. But in this particular one, the executive order that was put out by President Biden's office, the White House, on May 12th, looked at, it's a directive for improving the nation's cybersecurity after those several high-profile attacks and incidents, and primarily around that Colonial Pipeline attack was around that time as well. So the persistent threats from malicious activity on federal network and infrastructure kind of forced them into this. And if we look at it, it puts the onus on the government to lead the adoption of cybersecurity best practices, such as zero trust and secure cloud services, the deployment of encryption and multi-factor authentication. So there are some requirements in there. But it also forces better intelligence sharing among vendors and across multiple agencies, where prior to that, you know, different agencies or different vendors may have all been working independently with each other, but now there's a move to actually bring the log data together and to actually start sharing it and protecting the federal government as one. So that's got to be a good thing.
So, and I agree with you, right? But there's skeptics out there, right? Because, you know, at least here in the United States, there's been prior cybersecurity activity, right, in the form of legislation and some government restructuring. And there's some out there who, you know, believe that we just continue to shuffle the deck, if you will, right? And information security sharing by itself should not be a bad thing. However, there's also different motives out there between public and private sector.
There are, and I'm kind of on many things with legislation or regulation or a report like this or requirements in this way. I'm often one of the skeptics.
Same here.
Yeah, because you look at something, and one thing that governments are not very good at is being very fast. And what you'll see is legislation follows an incident like this, but by the time something becomes legislation and actually happens, you know, we're on to the next, we're on to the incident three ahead, you know, four ahead, because it takes time and it takes process. But I actually think this particular one was written in generically enough that it gives scope for innovation and gives scope for people to do things that are more general. Does that make sense? Because it's when regulation gets specific and you stifle innovation and you stifle people actually doing things in an inventive way. But I think this was kind of broad enough that it still allows that.
And I like that, right? There's some optimism there. Having done some studies, right, I think it's worth mentioning, though, that the legislation and then the action, right? So you write a law, then the implementers are often don't always know intent, right? So, and I think that that's really always this fine line to give the creative flexibility, right, and not really limit somebody to what they can or cannot do, as well as having, you know, the expertise, you know, to then carry that out. So it will definitely be interesting to see in the coming months, years, and whatnot.
Well, and if you think about it, if something lands on your desk that says, hey, John, you need to go and audit all your systems and you need to go and look at them and you need to make sure they're secure. And yes, you've got a bit of a checklist in front of you that you need to go down and make sure that's happening. The fact I'm landing something on your desk that makes you go and do that audit and makes you think about what's happening in your organization, that in itself is a great security, cybersecurity point of time, because it's kind of that slap of, please go and do this now. Go and look at it. Go and make sure you've got these things in place, even if you don't know fully how to implement them or you interpret them in different ways. I mean, we've seen similar things with privacy legislation. Yeah, if you take GDPR in Europe and then you look at, for example, CCPA here in California where I am, you know, those pieces of privacy legislation made businesses sit up. They looked at their processes. They had to walk around and audit where their data was. They had to understand what they were collecting. And security has hopefully improved. In fact, I think I can pretty much say private security around some of that data has definitely improved. So hopefully, if nothing else, this report will be that catalyst moment that makes somebody go and audit what they're doing.
Very good. So what should businesses be doing to prevent the ransomware attack, you know, and should one happen, be prepared to not to pay and recover?
Disconnect everything from the internet and don't allow employees to use any of your IT systems.
I love it.
Yeah, that's my British sarcasm coming through. Yeah. But obviously, one of the things is to make sure that you think about this. I think to me, there's two kind of several parts to this. There's one, the prevention. Yeah. And the prevention is super important. So, for example, and you mentioned I'm from ESET, the endpoint is critical. Yeah. Because if I can stop somebody from making that mistake of clicking on the wrong attachment or, you know, giving away their credentials on the endpoint, if I can actually stop the phishing attack or whatever it might be on the endpoint, make sure the endpoint has cybersecurity software, such as ESET, on the endpoint, and it's up to date and it's active. Yeah, I think we often forget in today's security, you know, the endpoint's something we've always protected, isn't it? And I wonder whether it gets enough visibility in today's world. So that, to me, is really super important. Then you've got the detection and response should something happen. Because, of course, there are other ways that cyber criminals can get in, et cetera. And as you know, we discussed earlier on around those Microsoft vulnerabilities were a good example of that. Yeah, you know, having technology inside as well. So for example, EDR systems and monitoring for threats internally is super important as well. And understanding which ones of those you need to investigate and working with experts in the field. An EDR, again, you know, I will call out the ESET product here because I'm from ESET, but make sure you have plans around detection and response as well. And then if you look at the other things, of course, there's maintaining backups. Yeah, super important. And what I had a friendly discussion with a company very close to where I live the other day about their backup strategy because I offered them some advice on how to protect some of their network, just as a friendly advice, because I know somebody in their business. And one of the things they do is they back up online, and they only back up online in real time. Where, unfortunately, as a cybersecurity person, I'm going to look at that in turn and say the problem is the cyber criminal will be in your network, look around, see what's going on, and they'll encrypt your backup. And then they're going to launch their malicious code at you, and suddenly your backup became useless because they've got that too. So you need to maintain what I define as an old-fashioned backup, a disconnected backup. Yeah, I think of the days when I started in IT, John, of the van pulling up outside and me handing the guy the tapes. I'm going back a long time. Yeah.
But there's something to be said for that, right, Tony? And even when we look at backup strategies, and are you backing up? And even if you do that, if you're backing up to a building, you know, or to a resource that's just 2 miles down the road, does that really help you in a case of a regional event, weather event, for example?
Well, so just to share some of my history with you there. So I worked for a bank in central London as a network manager in my early days in let's say IT, in networking. And actually, on the other end of the IT room was an ex-soldier, an ex-captain from the army, who used to sit there with maps all day working out if a terrorist bomb went off outside this building, where our next building needed to be. And actually, we had an underground bunker that was, in his view, far enough away from the first building that, and we built a disaster recovery center there. So you're absolutely correct. I mean, you need to consider, it needs to be offsite. But however, in today's world, I think that's slightly different, isn't it? Because back then there wasn't all the remote access, there wasn't all the VPNs, the connectivity wasn't there. If you wanted a connection, good connection from home, it was ISDN. So right. I'm showing my age here. but in today's world, realistically, if an event like that happened, you're going to relaunch your servers and relaunch your core, and everybody's going to go home. And in effect, right, we've just seen a mass example of that, haven't we? Of all of us being sent home to work.
Right.
Yeah. And if anything, you know, there's lots of things that have come from the pandemic that I would say are positive. I mean, there's lots of negative, obviously, that's come from the pandemic, but from, you know, because we've all now got remote access, we all know how to work from home, we've got better collaborative tools, there's better video conferencing, you know. And if you look at some of the positives, wow, look at the changes in education as well. I mean, the way kids have now adapted and can remotely work. So I think there's lots of interesting things, but having that strong backup, and more importantly, making sure it works.
Right.
Yeah. Having run through the entire process of actually doing a restore and a recovery, so a scenario where you've tested it.
Right. And I think that speaks to, there's an important point here, is it can't just be tabletop exercises. There actually has to be you going through the motions, right, of that. I think I would just touch on there, you know, you brought up, we transitioned a little bit into the pandemic and everybody working from home. And we, you know, you had talked about endpoints and the importance of them. And it ultimately, right, there's this thing to be said for, whereas we can't prevent all the vulnerabilities, right? At the end of the day, the only true secure, you know, computers are one cannot connect it to the network. And even then, somebody could pick it up and walk it right out the building, right? And you have a physical loss. But it, for enterprises of all sizes, principle of least privilege and need to know, right, ultimately should determine and drive, you know, initial access to your users, as well as a continued view. People change jobs, they get promoted, they no longer need accesses. Just tighten things down some.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's something a lot of, especially medium to smaller businesses, actually don't consider enough, is does that person need access to that data? And that's why, yeah, I mentioned GDPR and CCPA earlier on, and I think that's one of the good things about privacy legislation, because it makes you think about actually who is accessing that data and where they access it from and why they're accessing it. But one of the things that, and you mentioned there, you know, what about that missing device? That device left on a bar table or in the back of a car or left on a transit or whatever it might be, or falls into the wrong hands. And that's why it's also super important to have encryption on the endpoint. Yeah, make sure that you've got strong authentication on the endpoint. So you've got a good password policy for, you know, your domain. Make sure if somebody's accessing remotely, you're using multi-factor authentication. And that the device itself is encrypted and that you've got control of that encryption centrally. So, you know, to me, those three things are vital when you're starting to talk about this. And I will just call out again, you know, from an ESET perspective, you know, if you look at what we do, we provide that endpoint security, we provide encryption on the endpoint, and we do the multi-factor authentication. So, you know, to me, those three pieces are going to set you certainly in the right zone. You know, it concerns me that when you see companies not deploying those pieces or having a password policy where you don't have to change passwords for, you know, for 2 years or something, it's just, do you realize how many people use their work accounts? They're involved in data breaches. Somebody will go and get the password they've used on the last 15 systems and they're going to be in.
Right. Absolutely. So that's all a good point, right? And this is a nice segue to, you know, this next part of the report that talked about Microsoft's remote desktop protocol, RDP, is still the number one target of brute force attacks. Can you share more about attacks against remote access protocols and why cyber criminals primarily target RDP and not, say, SMB or SQL?
Well, so you need to think about RDP gives you that all-encompassing access, and that's the problem, is it is exactly what it says on the tin. It's a remote desktop protocol. So if you want to give somebody quick and easy access to the systems inside the network, then RDP is a good way to do this. When I say it's a good way to do this, maybe I should have rephrased that. It's an easy way to do this. So, yeah, you know, the administrator is already installed on all Windows devices by default. You know, you can switch it on and suddenly you're giving people access. Now, what should happen is RDP should be limited. So it should require, for me to have an RDP session, I should have first had to initiate a VPN session. And that VPN session terminating inside the network. And then if you make it that the RDP connection can only come from an internal IP address, suddenly I've taken away the risk from RDP being internet facing. But not everybody understands how to configure RDP in that way or protect it in the right ways. And we've done a lot of work. There's a great article actually on our blog site, which is welivesecurity.com, that explains how to secure RDP. Yeah. But unfortunately, it's still a weak point because a lot of organizations, I haven't locked down their RDP. It is internet facing. They haven't put on two-factor authentication, so multi-factor authentication. And RDP can be used to gain sysadmin passwords. It can be used to then install ransomware and basically cause the network a major headache.
Yeah, that's all good stuff. Well, I tell you what, Tony, but what an outstanding, report that your team has put together. Great conversation here. I'm going to, last question to you is, are there any additional steps that security professionals listening might want to consider to protect their organizations?
Yes. And I kind of jested on it earlier on of keep all the users away from the devices, but that's actually, we should not do that. We should allow, what we should do is enable people to use their devices safely. And one of the biggest things, actually, I think we can do is cybersecurity awareness training. And we as ESET provide this as a service to companies. So you can come along and there's a number of modules, et cetera. And actually, when the pandemic hit, we put out a free module very much around remote access. And you can access that from the ESET.com website. But it's important that, one, the training is refreshed on a frequent basis for content reasons, yeah, because as you and I know, unfortunately, the threat changes and new things can come along. But also, if we can push home and educate more that, you know, you shouldn't be using the same passwords on different systems, that you should, how to identify a phishing email, how to look at different social, understanding what a social engineering attack is, understanding what a BEC is, a business email compromise attack is, and how somebody might mimic or look, try and look like being your CEO if you work in finance and getting you to send payments out to a vendor that's actually a bad actor, you know, where somebody's imitating in that way. So cybersecurity training to me is absolutely essential. Now, a lot of insurance policies, so liability insurance policies, will turn and say you need to train your employees once a year. I actually believe that needs to be more frequent than once a year. Or certainly you need to run some scenarios and make it engaging that actually you're running that phishing part of that on a more frequent basis, maybe every 3 to 4 months, because I think that refresher is good for the employee, the company, and more to the point for the employee as an individual, because it will help strengthen their awareness of their personal stuff. We don't want anybody to fall victim of identity theft, for example.
No, that's a great point there. And I think that's the that's an overarching theme, right? Is, these, when you pre-plan training or your risk assessments and you're doing fixed interval, it leaves a lot to be desired, right? And at the end of the day, it's about continuous improvement, right? And, you know, you want to try to be better than you were the day before. And that's, you know, whether you're empowering your employees, corporate posture, whatnot. But the education piece is actually, precludes and it needs to predate somebody entering the workforce, which is a totally different conversation we could have, you know.
Yes. And it also needs to be a positive experience. Right. Different companies deploy this in different ways. If somebody doesn't get a good score, that doesn't mean we should be slapping them. If somebody has done the wrong, clicked on the wrong thing, it doesn't mean we should be penalizing them. You know, if you run a phishing scenario and somebody does happen to click on it, you know, you need to go back, you need to re-educate, you need to reteach them, you need to engage with them further. It's not about finding somebody that we can turn in and say, well, look, they're the bad person in our net, they're the bad employee that's likely to let us in. It's actually working with them to bring them up to scratch. In fact, I recently ran a customer panel. So we had a small conference called ESET World, and I loved it. One of the customers on the panel was a bank in the Netherlands. And when an employee reports a phishing incident or a phishing attempt to their security team, they send them chocolates. I love that idea.
That's an outstanding idea. You know, basically, you're reinforcing, mm-hmm. the behavior. I think an important distinction though is, and I totally agree with you, right, is we don't want to necessarily penalize the employees, but then there are this growing, I hope it's not a trend or even a theme, but that cybersecurity is not new. This isn't, we've been doing this for many years now. And at some point, oversight boards and whatnot, they have to take this, take it seriously, the due diligence. And I do think, tying back to your earlier point, maybe that's where the legislation there becomes a good thing, because if you don't do it, then you're basically being negligent.
Yes, and if you look at a lot of the privacy legislation, it's broad enough that they use the terms reasonable security. And then what that really means is you should be going to look at, for example, a framework like NIST, mm-hmm. and actually adopting a framework that is outside of the legislation and providing that reasonable security to industry best practice. And that's what I'd recommend actually for every size of business, is understand what some of those frameworks include, because most of what we've talked about today is right there in those frameworks around protection from ransomware, making sure you've got the backups, the crisis plan, and making sure you've got endpoint protection. That's all in a good cybersecurity framework.
That's all great stuff. Well, that's all we have for this episode. Tony, it was great chatting with you. Thanks again for joining me today. I'm John Brandt, and this was an ISACA podcast.
It's great to be here, John.
Thank you for joining us today for this episode of Page to Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode.